Right, diving right in today. We're going deep on a case that really throws you into the thick of it when it comes to environmental law and how it all gets tied up with, you know, holding businesses accountable.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is the kind of stuff that, honestly, as future lawyers, you guys are going to be dealing with. And Reed v. Reed, this case comes out of Indiana back in 2012. And it's like a textbook example.
It really is. And we've got a really, I think, fantastic set of materials to kind of break this down. We've got some insights that are really tailored for law students listening in. We've got this perplexity analysis, a good old-fashioned standard case brief. And then, of course, we've got the actual opinion from the court itself.
Perfect.
So our goal today is to really pull out those key lessons about, you know, who pays when the environment gets contaminated, how far does corporate responsibility actually reach, and even, you know, some of the procedural nitty-gritty, like how summary judgment works in these situations.
Love it. Procedural stuff. So important.
You got to know the rules of the game.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so to set the stage, we've got David Reed. He's our landowner in this case, and he owns this property in Scipio, Indiana. It's he's using it as an auction barn, rents out a section as a nursing facility. But back in 2004, he wants to expand his parking lot. You know, pretty typical stuff. So he puts up a sign, says he needs clean fell. Seems pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, on the surface, totally. Yeah. But this is where things take a bit of a turn.
Yeah.
So we have this steel fabrication company called North Vernon Drop Forge, for short. They see the sign and they deliver fill material to Reed's property. The problem is this isn't just any fill. It's got, you know, some nasty stuff in it, hazardous substances.
Uh-oh. So we got some red flags popping up immediately.
Yeah, definitely.
And as you might expect, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, IDEM, they get wind of this and issue violation notices to both Reed and Forge because of this contaminated soil. Mm. So now Reed, he's got a cleanup order on his hands.
Right.
So he hires an environmental consultant, wants to get this remediation done by the book, following all the IDEM instructions. Mm. But that's not where the story ends, is it?
Not even close.
Yeah.
Once Reed starts having to fork over money for this cleanup, he decides, you know, it's time for some legal action.
Right.
So he files this. It's a pretty hefty complaint. 14 counts against Forge, includes some of their employees, specifically Dibble and White, brings in the owner of Forge, Edward Reed, and even throws in some other companies that this Edward Reed owns.
Wow. Okay, so right off the bat, that's a really important point, I think, for anyone thinking about litigation, especially in the environmental realm. When there's harm done, like in this case, environmental harm, the web of who you can potentially hold responsible, it can get really big really fast.
Yeah, totally. You can't just assume it's one bad actor, right?
Absolutely not.
It can be this whole interconnected network.
All right, so 14 counts, this guy's covering all the bases. What exactly is he alleging?
He hits a lot of different legal points. But I think for our purposes, for this deep dive, that key claim is what's called an environmental legal action. It's under Indiana state law.
Okay.
And it's really the heart of this case. But he also throws in some other things, illegal dumping, nuisance, saying, hey, you're messing with my property, my right to use it. Then there's fraud, trespass, you know, because they came onto his property with this hazardous material, breach of contract. There was that expectation of clean fill. Remember unjust enrichment saying, Forge, you benefited unfairly from all of this at my expense, and even reckless endangerment. He's pulling out all the stops.
Yeah, he is. So strategically, it's interesting to see that broad approach. Now, procedurally, did this go straight to a full-blown trial?
Not quite. So Reed tries to get an early win, right? He files this motion for summary judgment, specifically targeting that environmental legal action claim, that ELA claim, and the issue of corporate liability. He's trying to say, look, Reed and all his companies, they're responsible. We don't even need a trial to figure that out. And of course, the defendants, they're not just going to sit back. They file their own motion saying, whoa, hold on. We should actually win on most of Reed's claims right now, right here.
Okay, so we've got this legal back and forth. How did the trial court handle all of this?
Well, they sided mostly with the defendants, actually.
Interesting.
They denied Reed's motions for summary judgment and granted the defendants' motions on almost every single count. The only ones that survived were negligence, specifically against Edward Reed and one of his other companies, Reed Machinery, Inc. So Reed's still got a big fight ahead of him.
Yeah, no kidding. Okay, so this brings us to a really important point, I think, for anyone who wants to get environmental law in Indiana. It's this environmental legal action claim. You mentioned Indiana has a whole statute dedicated to this.
Right, right. It's Indiana Code Chapter 1330.9. And this is like, this is your bread and butter if you're going to be doing environmental litigation in Indiana. This statute, it basically says, landowners, you can get back the money you spent cleaning up contamination from the people who caused it.
Okay.
And this is important. It says they can recover these costs even if they themselves played some part in the hazardous substances being released.
Hold on. Even if Reed had something to do with this whole dumping thing, he can still sue and get his cleanup costs back from Forge.
Exactly.
That seems kind of counterintuitive, I guess.
I know, right?
Yeah.
But that's kind of the unique thing about this statute. So the big question the Indiana Supreme Court had to tackle with this ELA claim, it all came down to whether the trial court was right to grant summary judgment to those defendants.
And what did the Supreme Court ultimately decide?
They actually overturned the trial court's decision on that ELA claim. Yeah. They said, look, there's this genuine issue of material fact, a real disagreement about the facts of the case that could totally change the outcome. And this needs to be decided at a trial.
Huh.
It highlights that civil procedure thing.
Yeah.
Summary judgment, it only works when everybody agrees on the key facts.
Right. It has to be super clear cut.
Exactly.
So what was the specific sticking point, the fact that everyone was disagreeing on?
It really boiled down to whether Reed actually gave the okay for this contaminated fill to be dumped on his property.
Okay.
Reed said in his deposition, look, I wanted clean fill. I put it on the sign. And he says, when the delivery started, I saw junk in there and I told Forge to stop bringing it.
Okay, so he's claiming he was pretty clear about what he wanted.
Exactly. But the defendants, they came back and said, no, 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 Reed was there when we were dumping. He even helped spread the stuff around. That means he approved.
So basically a he said situation.
Yeah, a classic he said, she said, right? It's this big disagreement about consent, a key part of the claim.
Right.
And as our trusty podcast guide for law students points out, that kind of conflicting evidence on a crucial fact like consent, that's a huge roadblock for summary judgment. The court can't just decide who's telling the truth at this early stage. That's what a trial is for.
Right. And the standard case brief, it lays out the rule nice and clearly that a landowner can sue to get those remediation costs back, no matter how much they were involved in the contamination itself.
Yeah, that's that Indiana statute in action.
Which tells you something about Indiana's priorities,
totally.
Right?
Totally.
It's like, let's get these contaminated sites cleaned up, and then we'll sort out who pays later.
Exactly. It really puts that cleanup first. And there's a great quote, actually, in the case brief. It says, it is clear from the plain language of Indy Code 1330.9 that the legislature enacted the ELA statute to shift the financial burden of environmental remediation to the parties responsible for creating contaminations.
It's pretty straightforward.
It's all about making the polluter pay. Right. It incentivizes doing the right thing environmentally from the get-go.
Makes a lot of sense. Okay, let's wade into those murky waters of corporate liability. Reed wasn't just going after Forge as a company. He was trying to hold Edward Reed, the owner, personally accountable, and his other businesses too. What did the court have to say about all that?
This one's a bit of a mixed bag.
Okay.
So they upheld the trial court's decision to give summary judgment to those Forge employees, Dibble and White.
Okay.
The Supreme Court basically said there just wasn't enough evidence to say these guys were responsible corporate officers. To nail them with individual liability under the ELA, you got to show they had real control over the environmental side of things.
So in this case, the employees were off the hook. But what about Edward Reed? I mean, he owns the company, right?
Right, and presumably has a lot of control. This is where the Supreme Court went in a different direction from the trial court. They actually reversed that summary judgment that was in Edward Reed's favor. They said there's definitely a genuine issue of material fact about whether he should be personally liable. And this came down to evidence suggesting he was really calling the shots at Forge, especially when it came to waste disposal decisions. This goes to show, you know, that how involved a person is in a company, how much control they have, it can make all the difference in whether they're personally on the hook for environmental problems.
So this is where it gets a little tricky. How can someone like Reed, who owns the company, be held personally liable for what the company did? What's the legal logic there?
So generally speaking, there are two main legal theories you can use in these kinds of cases. One is called piercing the corporate veil, and the other is the responsible corporate officer doctrine. It's important to note that in this specific case, the Indiana Supreme Court didn't actually pierce the corporate veil.
So just to be clear, piercing the corporate veil, that's when a court says, forget this whole separate corporation thing. We're holding the shareholders, the owners, personally responsible for what the company did, for its debts, everything.
You got it. And that podcast guide for law students, along with the case brief, they lay out the factors that courts usually look at when they're deciding whether to pierce the corporate veil. Things like whether the corporation was undercapitalized, did it even have enough money to operate properly? Were there proper corporate records? Were there fraudulent representations made by the shareholders? Did they use the company to do something shady or illegal? Were they paying personal bills with company money? Was there that classic commingling of personal and corporate assets? And did they just completely ignore basic corporate formalities?
So lots of ways to mess up, basically.
Yeah. And that case brief has this great quote that really sums it up. It says, "The propriety of piercing the corporate veil is highly dependent of the equities of the situation, and the inquiry tends to be highly fact-driven." It's not just ticking off boxes.
Right.
Courts really dig into the specifics of each case to figure out if it's fair to go after the owners personally.
Okay, so they didn't pierce the corporate veil in Reed's case, but he could still be held liable. How does that work?
That's where that second theory kicks in. It's called the responsible corporate officer doctrine.
Okay.
It doesn't completely get rid of the corporation, but it says that certain officers in the company, if they have the power and responsibility to stop or fix environmental violations, they can be held personally liable if they don't do it.
Right.
So the court found enough evidence to suggest that Edward Reed, given all his control over Forge, he might fit the bill for liability under this doctrine.
So it's a more targeted approach.
Right. And it's important for law students, or really anyone studying this stuff, to grasp that distinction.
Mm.
Piercing the corporate veil is this big umbrella concept, and then you have these more specific doctrines, like the responsible corporate officer doctrine, that apply in certain situations, especially in environmental law.
Absolutely. Okay, Reed also delves into another really important concept, I think. It's successor liability. This comes up in relation to Jennings Manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
What's the deal there?
Yeah, this one is interesting. So basically, Jennings Manufacturing was trying to say that it shouldn't be held responsible for any of Forge's environmental messes.
Mm.
It seems like they were trying to distance themselves from the whole thing.
Yeah, kind of wash their hands of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the Indiana Supreme Court, they weren't buying it. They said, look, there are some serious questions about whether Jennings Manufacturing could actually be held liable as a successor to Forge. And they pointed to two legal doctrines. De facto merger and mere continuation.
Uh-oh. More legal jargon.
I know, right?
Break it down for us.
Okay, so these doctrines basically exist to stop companies from weaseling out of their obligations just by changing their name or selling off some assets.
Clever.
De facto merger, that's when two companies basically become one, even if they don't officially go through a merger process. It usually means the same people are running things, the same business operations, same ownership, everything. Mere continuation is a little narrower. That's usually when a company basically just reincorporates with a different name, but the same people are in charge.
So same company, different outfit.
Pretty much.
What was the evidence that maybe this de facto merger or mere continuation was happening between Forge and Jennings Manufacturing?
Well, the court pointed to a few things. Edward Reed owned both companies.
Okay.
Their operations and assets overlapped significantly, and it seemed like Jennings might have taken on some of Forge's liabilities or just kept running Forge's business as usual.
So the court was looking for clues that it was basically the same business, just with a different name tag.
Exactly.
So I guess the general rule is that if a company buys another company's assets, they don't automatically get saddled with all the seller's debts and liabilities.
Right. As a rule, that's true. The standard brief actually quotes this principle directly. It says, when a corporation purchases another corporation's assets, the buyer typically does not assume the seller's debts and liabilities. But like I said, you have these exceptions with successor liability doctrines, specifically de facto merger and mere continuation.
Right, right.
They're there to prevent companies from playing legal games to duck their responsibilities. If the new company is essentially the old company in disguise, the court can hold them accountable.
So the trial court gave Jennings a pass on this successor liability thing. Did the Supreme Court overturn that too?
They did. They sent that whole issue back to the trial court, said they needed to dig deeper into the facts and figure out if either of those doctrines, the de facto merger or mere continuation, actually applied.
All right. So we've covered a lot of ground here. The Supreme Court did agree with the trial court on some things, right?
Right.
What claims got dismissed and stayed dismissed?
Those unjust enrichment and intentional tort claims, remember those? Those were affirmed by the Supreme Court.
Right.
The court said, look, Reed just didn't show enough evidence that Forge had gotten some unfair benefit at his expense. which you have to prove for an unjust enrichment claim to stick. And then with those intentional tort claims, things like fraud and reckless endangerment, the court said Reed hadn't really shown that Forge acted with the intention to cause harm. It highlights that even in cases like this with pretty clear environmental contamination, you can't just throw around legal claims. You gotta have the evidence to back them up.
Okay, let's do a quick recap, especially for those law students listening in. What are the key legal tests and the nuances we've talked about? If you're trying to really get this case, what should you remember?
All right. So with piercing the corporate veil, remember those eight main factors. Mm-hmm. Undercapitalization, the corporate records, was there fraud? Was the company used for something illegal? Did they mix personal and corporate money? Did they ignore those corporate formalities? And overall, was there bad behavior by the shareholders?
Right.
But keep in mind, these factors, they're very fact specific. It's all about the context of the case.
And what about successor liability? What are the key takeaways there?
So the basic rule, a buyer of assets doesn't usually take on the seller's liabilities, but those exceptions, the de facto merger and mere continuation, they come into play when there's basically no real change in the business, just a change in ownership or structure.
Okay.
So the big thing to look for is that continuity. Is it the same ownership, same management, same operations?
All right. Bringing it all home.
Yeah.
What are the absolute essential lessons from Reed v. Reed? What should any aspiring lawyer, especially those focused on environmental and corporate law, take away from this?
I'd say there are three big ones. First, that Indiana Environmental Legal Action Statute, the ELA, it's a powerful tool for landowners dealing with contamination. It lets them recover cleanup costs, even if they had some part in the problem.
Right.
Second, when it comes to corporate liability in these environmental cases, you've got to be nuanced in your thinking. You need to understand that difference between piercing the corporate veil to go after the owners and using something like the responsible corporate officer doctrine to hold specific officers liable based on their roles and responsibilities.
Right.
And lastly, never forget about successor liability. Companies can't just reorganize or sell off assets and expect to escape their environmental obligations if the new entity is basically the same old polluter with a new name.
It's like putting lipstick on a pig.
Exactly.
Yeah. And for anyone who's really paying attention to those civil procedure lessons, this case is like a perfect illustration of how summary judgment works or doesn't work when there's a real dispute about what happened.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
If the facts are unclear, you got to go to trial.
Reed v. Reed is like this mini masterclass in how environmental law, corporate liability, and civil procedure all come together in the real world, you know, when you're dealing with actual contamination.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you guys move forward in your legal studies and eventually your careers, remember what Reed v. Reed teaches us. As businesses get more and more complex, more global, all these legal principles, we're going to need them more than ever to protect the environment and make sure corporations are held accountable for the impact they have. Think about this. How are we going to keep those principles relevant and effective as business practices and the global landscape keep shifting? That's something to really chew on as you guys become the next generation of legal minds.